Coming up, what an excellent day for why? This episode is brought to you by the letter Y. Why you do this to me, Dimi? And she she says that, and then she just looks at the camera and she holds up a little yellow letter Y. It's like, why you do this to me, Dimi? Oh yes, the Exorcist characters as guests on Sesame Street. I'd love it. That'd be awesome.
Oscar the Grouch thinks he might be possessed, and then Father Karras has to convince him that no, he's just a grouch. That would be great.
Yeah. Can you help an old altar boy out, Father? I'm a Catholic monster.
Oh, I'm just talking to my friend Snuffleupagus. Big Bird, who's Snuffleupagus? Oh, you know, I just make the questions and he makes the answers. On this alphabet board.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bert, you want to hear something funny?
You left your mother alone to die.
Mr. Snuffleupagus, that's not very nice.
Well, howdy, folks, and welcome to Minute 115 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate. Those all begin with the letter E, by the way. The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And I'm Alex Bledsoe.
Hey!
Hey! And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. And yes, folks, we are joined today by author and good friend Alex Bledsoe. You'll remember we had him on for a bonus episode to talk about his book Dandelion, which was inspired by the second Exorcist film. Is that correct, Alex?
Yeah, the entire inspiration for that book was basically, what if Exorcist 2 was a good story?
A lot of our listeners in our listener group like Exorcist 2, mm-hmm. but none of them like say that it is good. Mm-hmm. I think I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they're like, this is better than people say is usually what people say.
Well, I'm just gonna shut my mouth, and the opinions of Keenan Diaz and Alex Bledsoe do not necessarily.
No.
I'm in the camp of people who really like it, but at the same time, I understand the people who don't.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be the recurring idea there, that there's something there that is so interesting and cool, and maybe it's not an Exorcist sequel, maybe it's something else, but it's more worthy of attention than we have given it.
Right, yeah. I think we have maybe unfairly criticized it because it was standing up against the Exorcist.
Right.
Anybody going to take that?
Is that your phone, Alex?
It is. I was hoping my wife would get it. Hold on.
Okay. Hello, this is Linda Blair.
I just heard what you said about Exorcist 2, and I don't agree.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, that was the landline.
No. Or anything else you want to say about Dandelion?
Well, Dandelion is a Southern Gothic possession story. It's set in a small town in Tennessee. It's available from Falstaff Books, and if you're on Audible, you can hear the audiobook.
Yes, yes. I listened to that in my car driving to and from work. Thoroughly enjoyed it. So give it a listen, folks, or get a copy of the book. What do you call the non-audio a book, Lester? A book. Jesus.
A meat book. A meat book.
Wait. Yeah. Get an audio copy of the book, or get the incarnate version of the book.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, it is made flesh.
Yes. Right. The book made flesh. Ew, this book is made of flesh. And so now Alex is back in here with us. He specifically requested to do this minute with us, and we are so happy to have him again. Welcome back, Alex.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so Alex, what made you want to talk about this particular minute of all the ones that you could choose?
Well, first off, let me state that I absolutely loathe the version you've never seen.
Clutching my rosary.
I generally don't like it when directors go back and rethink what they've done, unless it's one of those situations like with, you know, Blade Runner, where the original version was never released. Mm-hmm. So that we got to see, you know, but this is just, you know, Friedkin and Blatty second guessing themselves. And mm-hmm. in my opinion, all they did was make a smart movie dumb. With, and this is why I wanted to be here, with the mm-hmm. exception of this scene.
Oh, right.
I think this scene deserves to be in the movie,
mm-hmm.
unlike every other scene they've added, every new digital effect, mm-hmm. every the new ending.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
None of that deserves to be here. But I can see the case for this scene,
mm-hmm.
and I think I can make a case for this scene.
Mm.
Well, I am generally in agreement with you, Alex. I wouldn't go as harsh as that, I suppose. But I have a show called The Exorcism, and you don't. So, yes, that's as harshly as I would go. But our guests can say whatever they would like on our show.
I want to say, Alex, you had me holding my breath for way longer than was necessary.
You thought he was going to come on and talk about how terrible this scene is.
Yes. Up. And I was like, oh my God, what have we done? And then he's, with the exception of this scene. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Alex and I are not alone, I think. But yes, this scene is super cool and super cool. And, but you're right. Friedkin was not just second guessing himself, but kind of even like second guessing and sort of like wondering what Blatty would like, you know, like what would Blatty do sort of as he's putting together the version you've never seen. And yeah, this is one that, yeah, I think should have been saved even in the theatrical version.
Right. I do believe that Blatty even like mm-hmm. specifically fought for this one.
Yes. Yeah. He was fighting specifically for this one a whole lot in the original editing, and Friedkin had won. And mm-hmm. then, years and years, decades later, is like, well, let's see.
Yeah.
Well, I have notes, lots of notes.
Great. Let's see. We'll get to your notes.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. I'm excited to talk about this minute. Okay. So our minute begins with Dimmy saying, "Why this girl?"
And it ends with him walking down the hall towards Reagan's room alone.
Alone? What's he doing? Doesn't he know that's dangerous? But before we talk about this minute, let us open our books, because it is once again time for a reading from the Book of Blatty. The priests left the room, stepping into the warmth and the dimness of the hall, where they both leaned wearily against the wall, their heads down and arms folded as they listened to the eerie, muffled singing from within. It was Karis who at last broke their silence. "You said earlier, Father, there was only one entity we're dealing with." "Yes." The hushed tones, the lowered heads, were confessional. "All the others are but forms of attack," continued Marin. "There is one, only one. It is a demon." There was silence. Then Marin stated simply, "I know you doubt this. This demon I have met once before, and he is powerful, Damien, powerful." A silence. Then Karis spoke again. "We say the demon cannot touch the victim's will." "Yes, that is so. There is no sin." "Then what would be the purpose of possession? What's the point?" "Who can know?" answered Marin. "Who can really hope to know? And yet, I think the demon's target is not the possessed. It is us, the observers, every person in this house. And I think the point is to make us despair, to reject our own humanity, Damien, to see ourselves as, ultimately, bestial, vile, and putrescent, without dignity, ugly, unworthy. And there lies the heart of it, perhaps, in unworthiness. For I think belief in God is not a matter of reason at all. I think it finally is a matter of love, of accepting the possibility that God could ever love us." Marin paused, then continued more slowly and with an air of introspection. "Again, who really knows? But it is clear, at least to me, that the demon knows where to strike. Oh, yes, he knows. Long ago, I despaired of ever loving my neighbor. Certain people repelled me. And so how could I love them, I thought. It led me to despair of myself, and from that very soon, to despair of my God. My faith was shattered. Surprised, Karis turned and looked at Marin with interest. "And what happened?" he asked. "Ah, well, at last I realized that God could never ask of me that which I know to be psychologically impossible. That the love which he asked was in my will and not meant to be felt as emotion. No, not at all. He was asking that I act with love, that I do unto others, and that I should do it unto those who repelled me, I believe, was a greater act of love than any other." Marin lowered his head and spoke even more softly. "I know that all of this must seem very obvious to you, Damien, I know. But at the time, I could not see it. Strange blindness. How many husbands and wives," Marin uttered sadly, "must believe they have fallen out of love because their hearts no longer race at the sight of their beloveds. Ah, dear God," he shook his head. And then he nodded. "There it lies, I think, Damien. Possession. Not in wars, as some tend to believe. Not so much. And very rarely in extraordinary interventions such as here. This girl. This poor child. No. I tend to see possession most often in the little things, Damien. In the senseless, petty spites and misunderstandings. The cruel and cutting word that leaps unbidden to the tongue between friends. Between lovers. Husbands and wives. Enough of these, and we have no need of Satan to manage our wars. These we manage for ourselves. For ourselves." The lilting singing in the bedroom could still be heard, drawing Marin to look up at the door with a distant stare. "And yet, even from this, from evil, there will finally come good in some way. In some way we may never understand or even see." Marin paused. "Perhaps evil is the crucible of goodness," he brooded. "And perhaps even Satan. Satan, in spite of himself, somehow serves to work out the will of God." So there we go. So again, a little more than we get in the movie, even the version you've never seen. And we'll talk about that, about its effect on the film. But first, fellas, what do we think of the scene in the book?
Well, I mean, it works fine in the book. It's far too wordy to ever work as a scene in a movie, right. Particularly that close to the ending. But it really does, you know, drive home, as if we needed more of it, drive home, you know, Marin's inherent wisdom and goodness. And the, you know, the fact that he is the antithesis of Karis's doubt and, you know, disbelief in both himself and, you know, God. And so having them discuss something there is a good moment to, because it's the point where they kind of start to switch places, you know, where Marin starts to get weaker and Karis starts to get a little stronger, and he gets even stronger. If it's not too much of a spoiler, later when Chris asks if Reagan's going to die and he says no, that's the point where he becomes the hero.
Right. I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah.
And this is the point where it starts.
Yeah, that's really interesting. No. Yeah. And, you know, as a novelist, right, you can have things near the end of this climax and then also bring up interesting ideas, like this idea of, well, how come, once you do an exorcism, that's it. You don't have to keep worrying about them. You don't have to worry about sequels coming in, where the demon's going to come back.
And this is pretty much Marin saying there will be no sequel.
There's only one. Yeah. Like, that's such an interesting idea. And in a novel, sure, you could do that, and you could have that, and people, you know, think rather than feel, because you'll come back to feeling in a second. In a movie, that's almost impossible, right? Like, has this ever occurred to you? Think about this idea.
Yeah, in the middle of the climactic confrontation, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think we're all on the same page about this wouldn't quite work in the movie. But what do we think of just the scene, like in the book.
Yeah, it's really touching. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, this will be the most that we hear from Marin, I suppose, even though we existed in his head in the opening a little chapter, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but this will be the most we actually hear about him sharing his thoughts and sharing his past. And so we don't have any of that anywhere else, I believe.
Right. I mean, we got Clancy.
That's right. Yeah.
But no, this is the first instance of him, you know, I mean, he's not saying it directly, but he's like, right. He's like, oh, yeah, like, you know, this demon knows me and all of those things it was saying back there about me being prideful and, you know, disdainful of other people. Like, yeah, that is true.
It was true. Right.
Yeah.
So everything that the demon says in there is true, including Elvira being alive and Sharon having at least had a thought or a dream about Father Karras, and all of it's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, true or
I think it's true because the impact on the individual people is what counts. Not that everybody else knows about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's what that individual person thinks. And that's because, I mean, you know, obviously it's not unreasonable for Sharon to see a hot priest and have the occasional thought about it, but it's going to be really embarrassing to her with the priest in the room.
Right. Yeah, I think we talked about this in a previous minute. I think, like, if not objectively true, then at least true to the people that it is affecting. So, like, to Chris, this is her fault. You know, and Howdy said as much. And to Sharon, that one little, you know, that fleeting thought of Karras was enough to make her a bad person. And Howdy caught that, right?
Yeah. Well, also in the book version, because it's you know, goes deeper and broader, this idea of attacking this girl and that the girl isn't even the point, right? That's not quite addressed in the film version even.
Right.
Yeah, the idea of, like, the target is not the target. And as someone, you know, who came of age with 9/11, right? That's like the thing that made us grown-ups, you and I, Lester. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, because we would have been, you know, in 11th grade or 12th grade. And
that was a very stark line between,
yeah. It's like we were children and then we were grown-ups. I mean, I don't want to overstate for everybody, but, like, that's a pretty big moment.
Yeah.
But, like, the idea of, you know, so growing up thinking about terrorism like that, or coming to adulthood and thinking of terrorism. So what Marin is describing here sounds to me like terrorism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, it doesn't actually, the people that we kill in the plane crashes or what have you aren't the target. Mm. It's everyone else responding to it. And then in the case of terrorism, right, like, it turns you afraid. So now you're afraid to go to the grocery store, or you're afraid to go on vacation. It turns you into a soldier instead of living your life as a civilian, which is what you should be doing, right?
Breaking
on edge the whole time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like, breaking your spirit, breaking your your, like, identity down to this reactive, scared thing.
Right. Yeah. And sending us, you know, as it happened, right, sending us into wars that we wouldn't have done otherwise. And, like, and, like, everybody's supporting it and being like, yes, that's the right thing. Like, we are always on guard, and we're always thinking about who to attack, where, you know, if the terror attack wasn't successful, we wouldn't be thinking about Pokemon or whatever.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
Not to interrupt, but if I may, I've got a quote here from William Friedkin, quoted in Mark Kermode's BFI Classics book on The Exorcist, in the first edition of that.
Right.
He says, quote, "It's like the whole movie was about what they were talking about, so why are they talking about it?" Blatty's feeling was that he had to have his characters sitting there and explaining the picture to the audience. I felt that we did not need to explain it, that the audience should fill in everything for themselves. The worst thing you could do was to actually tell them what this was all about. And I agree with that, because in a dramatic sense, that's covered in the scene where Reagan, as Captain Howdy, says that the exorcism will bring us closer. And Karras asks, "You and Reagan?" And she replies, "You and us." Because the implication there is that Reagan was never the target.
Yeah.
But the people around her. It's subtle, but it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really, I totally understand everything that Friedkin is saying, right? Like, that, yes, that makes perfect sense to me, that you should be able to do all of it. But, you know, they do discover as in the script, like, a 5/8 page version of it that's not quite hitting yourself over the head, you know.
It's not
monologue after monologue, but I think it represents a good middle ground, actually.
Yeah.
And there's an aspect in this that is not, it is subtly done. And it's, we get one important bit of information here is that Marin not only knows the demon, but knows what it wants. And there's another, the other implication is that this is the reason for all possessions. And by passing this information on to Karras, who obviously he doesn't know what's going to happen at the end of the movie,
right,
he might very well consider it educating the next generation of exorcists.
Yeah.
By this point, he has to know he's in mortal danger of not surviving. And so by sharing this understanding with Karras, he hopes to pass on an insight that might help Karras survive and succeed.
I really like that, Alex. Thank you. So I think folks already know I do like this scene. I've been waiting to talk about it. To me this is the heart of the whole story. We have several valuable revelations in this scene in the book. Firstly, we have an explanation as to why the possession is even happening. Like you said, Alex, what's Howdy's game plan, and you know why Reagan specifically? Marin says it's not so much Reagan as it is the people in her life, right? The people who love her, and that's been like the basis of my thesis. You know that all of these characters are possessed, quote unquote, in some way, you know, possessed by guilt, possessed by doubt, by despair, right? They're all wrestling with something. They're all fighting their own inner demon, you know, before Howdy even shows up. And Reagan is the central hub from which Howdy can attack all of them and also take this person that they all love and care about and torture her in front of their eyes. It's the most evil thing that he can do. So that's one revelation. Marin speculates that Reagan is not the target, like we observed. Another one that we've alluded to is why Howdy is doing this. And this is something that has fascinated me as well. Dimmy sort of confirms with Marin that Howdy is not tainting Reagan's soul. She is not sinning. Anything Howdy does is on Howdy. Reagan remains innocent. I remember being so relieved when I first read this. Like, okay, yeah. So demons can't just like forcibly take your soul away from you. They can't drag you to hell. That's not a thing, right? Reagan's soul is not at stake.
Or if they murder someone in your body, you don't go to hell.
Right, right. Or if you die while they're still in there, you don't go to hell. Right. Yeah, like back when I believed in demons, I was terrified because I thought like a demon could potentially randomly attack you and damn you to hell forever, even if you didn't sin, right? But you think about it now, that would be like you going to jail because a burglar broke into your home.
Right.
So then, yeah, I'm with Karras. Like, if they're not after our souls, then why? And Marin's answer is so fascinating to me. Howdy wants them to feel bestial. Bestial? Bestial? What's it?
Bestial.
Oh, okay.
Like animals, like beasts. Ugly, vile, putrescent, and unworthy. And it made me realize how much of Howdy's attack methods are based on grossing you out rather than physically hurting you. We talked before about how unique this demon is compared to previous depictions of demons and even ones that come after this movie. This devil isn't shooting fire from his eyes. He's not physically attacking you or Reagan with anything supernatural. He does nothing overtly supernatural. All he does is make Reagan piss and shit and vomit, right? These are all human bodily functions, right? And every human does these things. And what's more, these are functions that we are ashamed of and embarrassed by. We know everybody does these things, but we'd just as soon pretend that we don't, right? Humans all over the world have this unspoken agreement that we're all just going to pretend that we don't defecate like the other animals, right? We acknowledge that we are animals. We acknowledge that we must do these, you know, gross things, but we're all going to like pretend that we don't.
Well, if I could insert something here, the idea of, you know, defecating and urinating in animals, it serves another purpose. They mark territory. They leave, you know, they summon mates. They, you know, there's not only just a reason for them to do it, to get it out of their body. There's a reason for their life, the way they conduct their lives, for them to do it where they do it.
Right.
We don't really have that. We don't do it for any reason other than to get it out of our bodies.
So for us, it's shameful.
Yeah. Right.
That's what it's there for, to shame us and to support big public restroom who has to build these things with public money. Yeah.
Yeah. speaking of public restrooms, right, like the way that they are designed, right, they are very discreet and they're very out of the way, like with private stalls, right? Like the bathroom in our house is also private, right? It's behind that door, right? Nobody else is in there while we're in there, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be decorated with marble and lovely furnishing and perfumes. And there's like a luxurious bath fit for like a Roman god or goddess, because we still think deep down that that's what we are, right? We're not animals. And as humans collectively, we sort of have this unspoken agreement to keep that illusion alive. We're Greek and Roman gods, right? We don't poop.
I've heard the upper middle class version, though, is that bathrooms are ocean themed and children's bathrooms are fish themed. That's just something that we all agreed on.
That's that having, you know, children and being middle class. Yeah, that's true. That is entirely true.
Like, we don't go and poop at the ocean. Why? Who came up with this idea that there should be seashells in our bathrooms?
I can't tell you how many times Dory from Finding Nemo has watched me do my business.
Well, doesn't she say? She's like, just keep pooping?
Like, well, she luckily, she doesn't remember from the last time. Because she's still, she's always smiling, so.
I sometimes sound like Dory when I've had, like, something that, you know, doesn't agree with me. I'm like, ooh. Yeah. But yeah, you know, I mean, like, as much as we don't want to admit it, you know, everybody poops.
Right.
And so Howdy is reminding us. He's like, hey, this is what you are. This is all you are. You're just an animal that learned how to wear clothes and drive cars. And isn't that silly? And you think God loves you because what? You're a little smarter than the other animals? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, wait, because you have a conscience, right? You have the ability to discern right from wrong and make critical, ethical, unselfish choices, which humans always do, right? With your big brains. And this evolutionary fluke is what makes you think you're special, that you must be singled out by God. You're like his pets or something. Mm-hmm. Oh, what's that? Oh, his children. Wow. Yeah, you're right. No other animal has the intelligence to be that delusional. Sorry to burst your bubble, but I actually know God. I've met him. Right. You guys are a poor imitation. And if I wasn't already, the sheer presumption would be enough to make me puke. Mm-hmm. You think you're like God? You think this girl is made in God's image? Does she look like God right now? Oh, God loves her, right? So why is he allowing this? And how about you? Do you possess that same compassion, that love that God has? Or, and let's be honest here, aren't you just a little bit grossed out by this girl? Aren't you repelled? And that's the biggest hypocrisy of all. You can't even see past the puke to love this girl, just like you couldn't see past that dingy apartment, Dimmy. You're grossed out by your own grossness, which means God's love is either a lie or it's something that humans can't replicate and don't deserve. And I'm going to prove this to you. I'm going to take this girl that you claim to love, and by the end, her own mother is going to forsake her.
Mm. But that's, see, there's a flaw in Howdy's logic there. And I say this as...
Oh, there's several, I think.
Well, yeah, because there is no way that Chris is ever going to not love Reagan, no matter how disgusting she gets.
Yeah.
And I say that as a parent who has dealt with some pretty disgusting things coming out of my children over the years.
Right, right.
You know, yes, it's gross. Yes, it grosses us out. It makes us disgusted, but it doesn't affect how much we love our children.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, you know, that is, if anything, that's the proof of, you know, if God loves us like children, then that's the proof.
Yeah.
Because he's shared enough of that with us when he created us that we look at our own children the same way he looks at us.
Mm. Yeah. That is my favorite part of this story, is when you realize that Howdy has already, and I think I've said it before, it's like Howdy has already lost before the exorcism even begins. Because if his goal is this, if his goal is to make us despair and make us feel like we are unworthy of love, is his goal is to kind of like show that love is an illusion, and that, you know, and get these people that love Reagan to abandon her, he's already lost like 100 times over, because Carl and Willie and Chris and Sharon keep coming back into that room. They keep on changing the bedding. They keep on cleaning Reagan up and tending to her. And Chris is fighting tooth and nail. She's going past what, like 88 doctors, right? and talking to this priest and bugging him until he says yes, and then getting, you know, Marin over here. And it, like, just just that fact alone, that she has not given up yet after her daughter has, or after Howdy has committed murder in her daughter's body.
Right.
And she doesn't care. She's doing whatever she can. Come hell or, literally come hell or high water. But yes, folks, this is that much talked about moment on the steps. And I realize in the movie The Exorcist, where some other steps feature even more prominently, this can be a little bit confusing. So if you heard us refer to that scene on the steps in previous episodes, we were talking about this one.
Right.
Except when we weren't. There's a lot of steps in this movie, and it made me realize at least 50% of the McNeils' problems could be solved if they just, you know, rented a one-story house. Probably still a demon, right? Mm-hmm. But pushing Burke out the window would be a very different scene.
Yeah, I'm all right.
The rose bushes broke my soul.
We had trouble as we were trying to find things. We were like, Exorcist steps, we were Googling. And we're like, oh, we got to all these step sequences except for this one.
Yeah. So as a community, we have to agree upon, like, one of them is stairs and one of them is steps.
Okay. Well, I think that's the difference. Steps are outside, stairs are inside.
What?
All right.
I have never heard this.
Yeah, there's like the Odessa steps is outside, yeah.
But we call them the Exorcist stairs.
I don't know who does that. You know what?
You did that in one of our episodes. In our first episode.
We need to get all together and make some agreements.
You did not deny me one more time, Keenan, and then the cock will crow.
This is one of those things that when you are a writer and you're just typing something innocuous, like, you know, he went up the steps or the stairs or which is it? And then you're 10 minutes down a rabbit hole trying to find out if there is a difference.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just you spending your time Googling and saying it's research.
Of course.
You're really just procrastinating.
Of course. I'm a professional writer. That's what we do.
Yeah. That's part and parcel of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I am not yet a professional writer, but I certainly behave like one sometimes. Anyway, we do have steps and stairs, and we do have this scene, which was not in the original theatrical cut of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fans and movie buffs, they go back and forth on these new scenes in TVYNS, the version you've never seen. Roger Ebert famously is not a fan of most of the additions, but he seems to have mixed feelings about this one. He says it is interesting from a theological point of view, but interrupts the momentum. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Keenan. The theatrical cut still has them sitting out there on the steps in this moment of quiet, but it's much shorter and they don't talk, correct?
Right. So it is the entire scene just visually with no dialogue and it's just them sitting there thinking all the things that they're saying in the Blatty version.
Right.
So similar to what Alex was talking about.
And the implication of that scene is that they're losing.
Yes.
Mm, yeah.
It makes it a completely different build toward the climax if you think your heroes are locked in despair before they go in for the final round.
Right. Yeah.
As opposed to discussing what's going on and sharing, you know, sharing information and feelings back and forth is kind of like armoring up for the final battle.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if either is wrong or better.
Right.
It's just
exactly.
it's a preference. Like I said, out of all the scenes they added, including that god awful bit with Howdy in the stove hood, does that void the warranty, I wonder?
That's right. He's helping make shake and bake.
Yeah, you know?
And I hail.
Yeah.
Oh, you have the perfect accent for that. We really needed you when we covered that scene.
Yeah.
And it brought it all back when I heard you guys do it, because I went around saying it to my kids and they're like, as they do many times, what is wrong with you, Dad?
Yeah, but it's just shot, reverse shot of them thinking. And so it does have a break in the momentum, but I think Alex is right. I think that's the right way to put it. Like, it has certainly a different feeling out there. They are sitting there and they are not learning anything. So yeah, you're right. If they're losing, or if you're being, if you're thinking of it as more ambiguous, right, they are not learning anything at least.
Right.
They are not sharing information. They are not becoming mentor and mentee.
Right.
I talk to my students about, like, if you were really adapting Hamlet for film, you know, you wouldn't have soliloquies if you're really doing it.
Right.
But of course, every version of Hamlet needs to have the soliloquies because that's, you know, Hamlet, right? But if it were to be or not to be, that is the question, whether there's nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, et cetera, right? Cinematically is, he picks up the knife, he looks at his wrists, he looks up, end of scene.
Right.
Right.
And maybe we have a close up on the knife or something like that.
Yeah. There's you could do it. It's like name that too. And I could do that in three shots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. But oh no, I have to do it in four or five shots. Right. Mm-hmm. But you don't need any of that dialogue to see him think about whether it's nobler to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, you can't do that in the Hamlet adaptation.
Well, you do it like Olivier did, where it's all voiceover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You just have it all voiceover.
And
yeah.
that's really fucking gripping, I tell you.
Mm-hmm. Right. But in the Lion King, the version of that, which is, you know, cinematic, is he's out there and the vultures are around him, and Timon and Pumbaa save him from the vultures. And he kind of looks off to the distance like, man, I wish they hadn't saved me from those vultures.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To be or not to be.
Yep. King. I just can't wait to be, open parentheses, or not to be, close parentheses, king.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm happy because we essentially have three versions. I'm glad that we get to have all of them for this part of the story. You know, we have the long moment on the steps in the book, and then we have the short moment with some dialogue in TVYNS, and then we got an even shorter version that kind of changes the whole mood of the thing in the theatrical cut, right? So of these, which do you guys prefer personally?
I prefer the scene with the dialogue.
Okay.
Because, like I said, to me, it gives you something you didn't have before in your knowledge of the characters, and it sets up the final confrontation differently and, to me, more meaningfully.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not trade even that scene if I had to take all the other crap with me. I am team theatrical cut all the way when it comes in total.
You can't even just like close one eye so you don't see the stove range and, you know.
And just go to the bathroom during the spider walk. No, because they're pretty fast.
No, you go to the bathroom the first time Reagan goes to the doctor because you know it's the first time. And you're going to have a whole second visit that you're going to have to go through.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say you go to the bathroom when Reagan goes to the bathroom. I was like, well,
that's a drinking game I don't want to play.
Right. Yeah, Roger Ebert says the one thing that he thinks is a better addition that Alex is disagreeing with is seeing the extra doctor sequences.
Right.
That is what he says. That's a Roger Ebert. Mm. So he says the stair one, he understands intellectually why that's a good idea. It's interesting. Mm. But the extra doctor sequences, are the other thing that are the positive addition for the
interesting. Yeah.
No, because the only reason those doctor scenes are there is there's a slight continuity thing where you know, Chris tells Reagan to take her pills. Now, at that point, we've also learned that Karis's mother has died, but not right away. Like, you know, she's been dead for a while.
Right.
So it's reasonable to assume some time has passed, and it's reasonable to be able, you know, as an intelligent film goer to pick up, oh, I guess they took her to the doctor at some point. That makes sense. I would do that with my child.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Uncle Roger says, it explains all this. Like, remember what the doctor said. But I like all the medical stuff. I don't think it slows down the movie at all. I think that stuff is terrifying. But anyways, getting back to the stair sequence, I'm sort of in between having none of the dialogue or this. I'm a little bit torn because the none of the dialogue is darker. It's more Friedkin-y. It's more of like what The Exorcist was that made it the classic. It's like these people are lost and there is no hope with this. It's bleaker. We're going to disagree when we get to this, but I like the bleaker, shorter ending as well. And you like the longer, more hopeful ending, the Blatty version of it. In general, we'll get to that. So I could live with it without any dialogue. What the dialogue does is kind of introduce the idea to Damien that he has to, it's sort of like Marin accidentally teaching Damien the solution to the mystery, which is that he has to accept that he's human and he has to accept what that means to be a human. And then that entails him, you know, sacrificing himself and not as a priest, but as a man. So that's really interesting, but I don't know if I want it.
That's a preference that you can only have when you've really immersed yourself into the story. Like we all have. When you're just approaching it that first time, I don't know that there's any, you know, if you're a one-time viewer who just likes horror films, I don't know that there's any qualitative difference in the scenes.
Yeah. Mm.
I will say that as much as I like Blatty, I really do like Blatty as a person. I like him as a filmmaker.
Right.
He and I had the same editor at one point.
Right.
And from everything I heard, he was, you know, a dream to work with.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very purple writer.
Yeah.
And his dialogue in the book often doesn't sound like human speech.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I can't, as a professional, I can't endorse that.
Alex, what are you talking about? I had some plumbing problems the other day, and I was calling, and I was, the plumber asked me to describe it, and I was like, well, you know, like alien code tapped out by a dead man. And he gave me the price, and I pounded my fist against the wall like it was time.
Yeah, Blatty likes people more than Friedkin does. I think that's just fair to say that.
That is so fair.
Yeah, he likes people. Friedkin is interested in people, and I think he understands people. But yeah, Blatty has this hope for them, for humanity that Friedkin doesn't. And I think that's this whole stare, cutting it out or keeping it in or bringing it back in. That's what this whole conversation is about.
Yeah, I do remember seeing a clip of them talking to each other, Blatty and Friedkin, about like the cuts they had made. This is, I think you can find it on YouTube, folks. I'll find it again and I'll post it in the show notes. But it's about them talking about their preferences. And one thing that Blatty kind of like jumps in and he interjects and he says, I just don't want anybody to think that the devil won.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so Blatty. That is Blatty to a T. And I think you're right, Keenan. He likes people. He has this hopeful, love will prevail, goodness will prevail type of feeling. And Friedkin is, you know, in the mind to be making a much different movie. And I think like the way that I came at this, so I saw the theatrical version first.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very bleak. And I remember having that kind of feeling with them sitting on the steps and not talking to each other. And then in college, I read the book. And for me, the book introduced not just good stuff, but like essential stuff. Like this is the moment when Dimmy realizes that he is young Merrin.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these very private doubts and fears were once felt by this person for whom Dimmy has this enormous respect, someone he looks to as a father. I love that in the story for Dimmy. This is his closure on all of that inner turmoil that he's been feeling all throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have Merrin's philosophy on the nature of evil, which obviously I also really like, right? Both the book and this version of the movie, the TVYNS, do service to this part. Paradoxically, I think it grounds this movie in its own version of reality, right? This book and movie have done an exemplary job in establishing a world where demons are real. And what I mean is, you look at other stories with demons or ghosts or aliens and you go, oh yeah, this is a world where demons can exist, right? And it's not surprising, right? The rest of the film, you know, even if it's about the real world, has the same color palette, if that makes sense, right? I'm not shocked to find that ghosts are real in Beetlejuice because the real world in that story is already a little bit off, you know?
Sure.
But somehow, in a movie called The Exorcist, it's a shock that demons are real. I think this is the gold standard for blending something fantastical into a story about the real world. Somehow, Blatty and Friedkin have made a world where demons absolutely do not exist, except they do. They have made demons as real as divorce or arteriograms or the death of a loved one. And so I think this is the icing on the cake here, is Merrin explaining Howdy's motivation. We have established that Howdy is real. We have to acknowledge that he is doing all of this for a reason, even if we don't know what that reason is. Perhaps it's beyond us. Fine. That makes it even scarier. But he's not just doing bad things because he's the bad guy in the story, right? He wasn't like handed a script and he's playing a role.
Yeah, but a world where demons really exists would end up closer to the way that Friedkin says it does in the theatrical cut than in what Blatty thinks would happen if they actually existed.
Blatty is, you know, he is Catholic to his core. He is going to see the world through that Catholic lens.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And in that Catholic lens, priests are heroes. They are the right. last line of defense. In Friedkin's world, which he has amply demonstrated in all of his work, you know, they might be the right person at the right time, kind of like Popeye Doyle in The French Connection, but they're not heroes.
Right.
They're, yeah, they are protagonists in the dramatic sense, but they're certainly not heroes, but they're capable of heroic acts like Demi is before the end. And,
really,
you know, that's Friedkin's world. That's, you know, and I wouldn't even, I don't know that I would go so far as to say it's the real world, but it's certainly the world that Friedkin has consistently depicted. So I think one reason that we are even here talking about this 50 some odd years later is the tension between those two worldviews. Because if it's all Blatty, you get something like the Ninth Configuration.
Right.
And if it's all Friedkin, you get something like the French Connection. But when you mix them together, you, in the right, you know, at the right time and the right percentages with everything firing on all cylinders, you get this kind of storytelling alchemy, really.
Yeah, sometimes people talk about the fights between Friedkin and Blatty, because that's typically how we tell stories about how movies are made. But I think they're more compromises between Blatty and Friedkin. Like, they were still friends after all this time, and then Friedkin, you know, 40 years later is thinking like, or 30 years later is thinking like, what if Blatty was right there? Let me think about that.
And like, when they were interviewing Blatty about, you know, his Oscar, He was upset that that Friedkin also didn't win. And he was like, oh, he should have won. You know, everybody should have won. He was championing Friedkin after the Oscars as well.
So they the fight between them, I think, is overstated or just misunderstood.
Quote unquote fight.
Because that's how I had heard it before we got to look at this movie. And then you look through it and it's not really. There were some times when Blatty is the producer. So he is, and he's the writer of the book. So he is Friedkin's boss. And if he really felt strong enough, he could have done something, I think.
He could have put his foot down. And there,
he could have put his foot down.
Yeah. And we have like film evidence of him admitting that he was wrong about the head spinning around.
The head spinning.
Well, I think the difference is that the so-called fights were never fights between Blatty and Friedkin. They were fights between their points of view. It was it never descended to personal fights. They were each trying to make the best movie. And when you have that, and you do reach a compromise, you know, you're going to have a better product. You're going to, and I hate to use the word product, you're going to have a better movie.
Well, I guess, that Blatty's vision of the world won out in that respect. Because if people were as terrible as Friedkin says that they are, then they would not have worked as well together.
But yeah, again, I like that we have like all three versions to choose from if we want. And I agree with you guys that like all of the dialogue from the book would not fit in a movie medium. So but I like that we get to talk about this minute here. So let's talk about this minute. We're still on Karis in this amazing close up. There are stark lines of light and shadow on his face, and the light is very bright. His head is tilted down, but his eyes seem to be looking up and away. And we see that little point of white light in his eye, and he says, "Why this girl? It doesn't make sense." I love how even now the logical Demi is trying to make sense of it. We get the impression that he's saying this to Marin, but he's not looking at him, which further separates them. They are alone, even though they're talking to each other.
We were talking in our last minute before you came on, Alex, about Lester's idea that these bars make them look like they're in cells.
Yeah, they do, kind of.
Yeah, which we haven't really done. We've seen this staircase a lot, but we haven't seen them used that way. And I dropped something into the chat, which is a link to a potential art reference here.
Let me
this is The Last Judgment, which is part of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. So this is the wall behind the altar. So it's this huge thing. And we've talked about this briefly in our Paradise Lost section.
Oh, is this the one where the snake is biting?
it's biting Minosh on the dick.
Yes.
So you can go through there and you can see a shot of Minosh getting bit on the dick by a snake. But that's not why I'm dropping this one in the chat. Going. It's a little bit
past Minosh.
This is
a Renaissance dick pic.
Right. So in The Last Judgment, it is depicting Jesus coming back. And he condemns a huge portion of the people in the picture and then saves some of them.
Right.
So it's mostly about being condemned. So right. we're looking at this. So it's a huge section, but one of the most famous sections is this relatively small piece of it that is called Michelangelo's Damned Man, or sometimes the Condemned Man, or the Man Damned to Hell.
Yes, I'm looking at that right now.
Yeah, and so you see, like, it's one eye open, and the man's being beset by demons and devils and another serpent, or whatever. But it is the guy's face with one eye wide open, like a gape, thinking about his future, what he sees, etc. And then the other hand is being used to cover the other eye.
Yeah,
and it's this famous sort of idea. And then if you look at this other link, like, this is the a spoiler for the end of the Maltese Falcon, where the bad guy, the Maltese Falcon, who I won't say on the air who it is, is condemned down in an elevator ride, similarly with this shadow covering their eye.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So that is really clearly, I would say, like Houston's version of the Condemned Man. And I was thinking about it here with Damien. With the shadows covering up one of his eyes, especially since Lester was talking about in the previous minute, like, okay, the devil's real. Now I have to sit and think about that. Am I condemned to hell? Right.
Right.
The devil's real. And we've said, like, the arc of the movie overall is like the devil's real. So Damien realizes God must be real. I don't think we're there yet. Right. I think it's, I think we're still in the moments where it's like the devil's real. What does that mean for me? And then my question, like, what does that mean for my mother? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think of that with this really interesting covering of his eye with these shadows here?
I am so glad you found these images. Yes. Oh, no, this is. Yeah, how can this not be? Especially, the condemned man on the Sistine Chapel. This, I mean, it looks, I love this. Thank you, Keenan.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Roisman was thinking about it, but it's a very famous, like, reference in Renaissance art.
Yeah. Let's put this up in the listener group. We'll put both of these images up,
Okay. Yeah. One's a spoiler.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. A man walking into the Sistine Chapel is like, oh my God.
That's me. I mean, this guy must look like some. I'm sure someone has walked in and be like, that guy looks exactly fucking like me.
Well, better than looking like Minos.
Right, yeah. Why's that guy, why's that snake biting my...
Oh, you know, so this is apropos of nothing, I guess, but up earlier it is, who is it? St. Bartholomew. So part of the painting is people who are condemned, and the other part is saints who Jesus has selected to go with him. You know, and it's St. Bartholomew, and he's holding his own skin.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. And so the author here at Italian-Renaissance-Art.com says that the skin is reputed to be a self-portrait of Michelangelo.
I can see why he did not do many self-portraits.
It's like a skin bag. Mika, the skin bag, Angelo. Yeah.
Michelangelo, I commission you to do this painting on the Sistine Chapel. But for God's sake, just cover your face because.
What's that artist's name? Oh, Skinbag Bonarotti. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I have never imagined what I would look like if all of my organs and bones were removed and I was just skin. But that's why I'm not Michelangelo.
Yeah, it takes the mind of a Michelangelo to contemplate those things.
Yeah, a Renaissance man.
Hey, boss, how are you going to show that Minos is damned? You just wait.
Yeah. Right. That recalls a self-portrait of mine.
What are you talking about? Of course I know what someone blowing on a trumpet looks like. Don't question me. I'm Michelangelo.
It's interesting if you look at a lot of his, particularly his portraits of women, it is very clear he does not know what women look like. Because it's the same male bodies just with boobs.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, on this page there's a Saint Catherine. And I was like, Saint Catherine, are you sure? She's really like ripped, you know, and like, you know, people come in all sizes, right? But like Michelangelo's women do not.
Yeah.
They're all these ripped male bodybuilders.
Folks, this will only work if you actually have the painting in front of you. But Michelangelo, I want you're going to paint Charon, the boatman, but I want his expression to be very complex. I want him to be thinking about all the souls that he is ferrying across the river. But I also want him to be thinking about his own soul and the mystery of his future. And Michelangelo's like, got it.
Yeah, yeah. Charon's face looks like a dog who hears his owner's voice in a ring cam for the first time. All right.
Okay.
Let's get past second five of our minute.
We can't even blame it on the guests. We've done faster episodes.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
No. Yeah. Okay. So, further separates him. So we're back on those steps, right? Dimmy has just asked why this girl. It doesn't make any sense. We cut to a close up of Marin higher up on those steps. His head is also down, but to where we cannot see his eyes. And where Dimmy had that light and dark contrast, Marin's face is almost entirely in shadow. We can see more of his face because the shadow isn't black like on Dimmy, but the light is very dim. And in response to Dimmy's question, he has this like minute shake of the head, and then like for 6 seconds he tries to articulate something. And again, I love that he doesn't have an immediate answer. He is also wrestling with this. And finally, he says, I think the point is to make us despair. Another pause, and he continues, to see ourselves as animal and ugly. And I feel like that last pause before animal and ugly is different. I don't think he was searching for that as much as confronting it. And after he says this, he sort of exhales through his nose, like, there, it's out. That's the ultimate question. How much of us is God and how much of us is animal? And now it feels like he can go on a little bit easier. And he says, as we cut back to Dimmy, he says, to reject the possibility that God could love us. And Dimmy's face has changed. He's lifted his head a little bit, and there is more light on his face. We see both of his eyes now. He's still not looking directly at Marin, but his eyes are turned in that direction, and we get the sense that he is listening really hard. This is that second inner demon that he still has to deal with, right? The first one was finally exercised, right? Is God real? Yes, he knows that now. But does he love me? Am I worthy of love?
No. That's just Billy Friedkin in the girl. No, you're not. No.
And ruined his own take with that. So I will ruin a take because I cannot stand any ounce of love. But no, like, that's the second demon that Dimmy is struggling with, right? Like, is he worthy of God's love? And as soon as Marin finishes speaking, Dimmy blinks and his eyes flick back to looking off in the distance. And I love the simple cinema language of that blink, telling us that he is thinking about what Marin just said. It's so amazing. Like, literally just a blink and a movement of the eyes. This is an actor who understands micro expressions are more than enough. The human face and the human perception are so fucking wild. I love it sometimes. So then we cut back to Marin, and it's really interesting here because it looks like they're both about to do something, and then they both do another thing. It looks like Dimmy is about to get up, but he's only shifting his weight. He's only shifting on the steps. And it looks like Marin is trying to say more, but then he ends up getting up. He grasps the railing, and he pulls himself up as he says, "Will you excuse me, Damien?" And at this, Dimmy does look around at him. And what do we make of this face here, guys? To me, he looks worried, like his sick dad has just started coughing, or maybe his dad with dementia is going to go do something dangerous, and he watches Marin go down the hall towards Reagan's room. What do we think? What do we think is happening on Dimmy's face right now?
Looks like a little child. I think you're absolutely right. We've been playing with light back and forth and making Damien look super old as he was in the last minute, or like this child surrounded by people who know what everyone knows what they're doing except for him.
Right.
He's like the kid that's not ready to drive the car by himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What if he does know, like, Marin I mean, he does know Marin could die at any moment. Right. They've been prepped for that that's in the ritual, the Rome ritual, and they've been prepped for that. And yeah, he knows that that could happen. And you can just look at him.
Yeah.
Just look at this guy. Right. He's ready to run for president. He's so old.
Yeah. And like a child who like intellectually knows about death.
Yeah.
Now his father is walking away and he's kind of like, you can almost see that realization on his face. Like, oh wait, like my father could actually die. Like death exists, but I never thought like for my father.
Exactly. And I think another thing is in the screenplay, which matches the book a little bit, it says interior hall outside Reagan's bedroom. In the darkness, Marin and Karis lean against the wall, their faces numb with shock as they stare at door to Reagan's room. And so the whole conversation here is them looking at Reagan's room door. It also includes the singing that we had in the screenplay earlier that's also in the book, right? So in that version of it, early draft of the script, but I think even if this were the shooting draft of it, like Friedkin and the actors found something better than the idea that they're taking a break, but the entire time they're just looking at the door and just waiting for the moment to go back in, right? Looking inward, exactly. So one is looking towards, in theory, at least not looking, but facing Chris's room. One is facing Reagan's room, but they're not looking at anything in particular, right? So it's not that they are still like one team here. And, you know, as soon as they're both give the nod, they're ready to go back into Reagan's room.
Literally crisscrossed,
They're crisscrossed applesauce, and they need some visual structure, right? So the blocking, the visual structure needs to change before any of them sees that the other one is ready.
Right. And then they're separated by the bars as well. Yeah.
So Marin gets up and you know, Karis has to worry like a dog, you know, again, who's like, hey, are you going to the car? Like, what is this? Except in this version, dogs hate car rides, you know? And this dog is looking up and going like, car ride? Oh God, no. Why car ride? Why?
Or if we're talking about a dog, this is could be like, oh, you're going out again? So this is the moment you'll never come back, right?
Yeah, except Damien, I think Damien is doubting himself and his ability to go on the car ride, right? Because it's not just like, oh, you're leaving and you could die. I hear you. That's all there. But it's also like, is Damien ready to go another, you know, 2 hours with this girl in there and get smacked around?
Can you imagine if they hadn't called Karis or they hadn't called Marin and Karis had to do this whole exorcism himself?
Yeah, which he wanted that. That's what he was asking
for. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But they were right. You know, he was totally not ready for this.
Right.
But I sometimes wonder what he would have been able to pull out of himself courage-wise if he had been the only one there.
Yeah. Or him and Dyer, which, you know.
Oh, God.
He would have been like, oh, yeah, I need my buddy there, my friend. But that would have been the worst combination possible.
Dyer would be cracking unless jokes.
They could move a piano into Reagan's room.
No chance that's going to fall out of any windows.
This one's called Red River Valley.
Right.
That's actually Dimmy's favorite song. A little thing from the book that we never got to.
Oh, he likes Red River Valley?
Yeah, that's his like childhood favorite song.
Oh, well, everyone likes Red River Valley.
Oh, yeah,
yes,
course.
Yes, it's very nice.
Yeah, be original, Dimmy.
So what context do they use that in? Because that song is very sad, and it's often used in Westerns because of its sadness, as it's about leaving a place and never being able to come back.
Yeah, it's when he's still in doubt as to whether it's a demon or a sick girl, and he has left the McNeil home, and he's like walking in the streets, and he hears somebody in the distance playing a harmonica, and Blatty just says he could hear them playing Red River Valley, Karis's favorite song since his boyhood.
I see.
Yeah,
sad. That's your favorite song as a kid. His serious, brooding kid.
I mean, that explains Dimmy so much.
Yeah, it sure does.
No wonder the whole Karis family has a hard time understanding what. What funny is.
Exactly.
There's only one Karis who understands funny.
Right.
That's the answer. Why you do this to me, Dimmy? Because you played Red River Valley every night of my life for 10 years. Think about that, Mom.
It's a happy song. You can dance to it.
Yeah, all they do in that house is think about their mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't say like in a functioning family, you know, or that makes you want to puke, where the parents are like, "So what did you learn today?" Mm-hmm. You know, and like, "Oh God." But yeah, in this family they say, "So what regrets did you have today?"
I want a deleted scene where it's Dimmy and Mama Karis and like Titosh has come over to visit, and he's having dinner with both of them. And you got Dimmy on one end of the table and Mama on the other end of the table, and just oblivious to everything is Titosh in the middle, and he's just chowing down on, you know, whatever Mama cooked. And there's kind of like this silent, you know, it's just like heavy, heavy, heavy with guilt. And Titos is just, you know, he's just smacking on a chicken leg or something like that.
Right. And Uncle Titos has come over, and she's used all the groceries up in the fridge. And Uncle Titos isn't paying attention that it's the 8th of the month, and that's all of Mary's groceries for the rest of the time. She doesn't have anything else except for a widow's pension. Mm-hmm. And he knows better.
He knows better. Why
Uncle Titos, he just doesn't care.
Yeah.
Life is a lark to Uncle Titos. Yeah.
You know, it's funny.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't even like chicken. anyway. But yeah, so Dimmy watches as Marin walks away in the direction of Reagan's room. We cut, and I think this new shot is set up for us to also think that maybe he's going back in that room. He's heading for it, but then he makes that 90-degree turn, and we realize he is heading for the master bathroom. That's how it's labeled on that floor plan that our listener sent us. I think we had speculated that this was Sharon's room before, but there's another whole wing of the second floor that we haven't seen according to this map.
Where would Sharon's room be?
Well, okay, so from where we are right now, right, in this shot facing Reagan's room, if we turn left, there is a door and another little set of stairs and a hall with two more bedrooms, a bathroom, and then one room just labeled ominously chamber. I don't know what that room is for.
I don't think we see that in this movie. Now we're at minute 115. Yeah, maybe we see it in Exorcist 2.
Yeah, maybe.
Because they come back to this house. Yeah. So maybe that's where they get that information.
I don't think we ever see that. Would you call it a wing? It's really small. It's just like it's a door, and then it's like another hallway with two more bedrooms and a chamber.
Yeah, a horse wing.
Yeah, there you go. Right?
Well, I think Sharon sleeps at the foot of Chris's bed in case Chris needs her for anything.
That's some good labor commentary from our buddy Alex Bledsoe. Yes, you're right. Yeah. That's what it is to have a live-in tutor / secretary /...
Yeah.
Well, she's obviously had some medical training.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think...
how did Chris know that she needed an assistant with medical training?
I think naturally it came up in the book. She's just... She mentioned... because it was the doctors who were saying, it's like, what, you want to administer... like treatment here at home, because that's what Chris wanted. And Sharon pipes up. She's like, "Oh, I can do that. I know how to do that." Right. And then everybody just turns and looks at her, and she's like, "Don't ask me how." No, that doesn't happen. But
right. And don't go in my chamber.
Yeah. And I think in the book, it says that Willie and Carl sleep downstairs, so they got like a room. Downstairs, maybe.
Where?
I don't know.
Well, not in the film version, at least.
Yeah, they, not in the film
room
version.
Downstairs, for sure, right?
No, there's definitely not. Unless they're sleeping, you know.
In Daddy's room.
That's what the chamber is for.
This is the Willy chamber.
Welcome to my chamber.
Yeah. I love this chamber now. But yeah, what is that chamber? Yeah, so in any case, Marin heads to this master bathroom. He enters, turns on the light, and closes the door. We then cut to inside the room. Behind Marin, he has just closed the door. His left hand is still up on it as if like leaning on it. And now his right hand, the one on the doorknob, comes up into frame, and he sort of holds there, like he's catching his breath, he's collecting himself. And we have seen enough versions of this shot where he's suffering in private. We've seen the nitroglycerin pills. We know that he is not long for this world. And once again, I get the feeling that his only concern is that he doesn't die before helping them. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only thing he cares about. And he's been doing this in private so as not to worry Dimmy or Chris. And so once again, even here at the end of the movie, our characters are facing their biggest challenges alone. Speaking of which, we cut back outside the hall, but it's a different angle because Dimmy has gotten up and he is walking towards Reagan's room, toward, though he may not know it, his biggest challenge. But we'll have to see what that is next time, because that is where our minute ends. And that is all of my notes. Alex, Keenan, is there anything else we want to add here?
Yeah, I have always wondered why the demon is never named. Because in all of my research, that was a huge part of any exorcism, any deliverance ceremony, is you have to name your opponent because that gives you power over them. Lester, do you remember many, many months ago when I sent you that page out of Blatty's nonfiction book where he names the demon as Pazuzu?
Yeah, I remember it.
I just happen to have it right here.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
He says, and this is Blatty talking, quote, "If I had to guess, I would say he is Pazuzu, the Assyrian demon of the southwest wind, but I'm not really sure," unquote. Now, granted, you know, I suppose that's feasible, but if anybody should know, in the whole, you know, panoply of people involved in The Exorcist, it ought to be Blatty. He ought to know, because demons have different personalities. And if you're going to depict one, it, you know, you have to know what they'll do, what they'll say, what kind of creature they are. And I don't know why he never felt the need to do that. I mean, granted, Pazuzu's a stupid name. if you see
to any ancient Assyrians out there, we
if you watch Exorcist 2, you will know just how dumb Pazuzu is when it's said over and over.
But in Futurama, the professor's pet demon is named Pazuzu. That's, so we can say, Pazuzu!
Pazuzu! Good news, everyone. A Pazuzu is here.
That was good, Lester. That was really good.
My favorite of his is, good news, everyone. Bad news.
But I've always wondered why, because I'm sure Blatty had to encounter the same thing. I'm sure in the Catholic ritual, it's just as important. But and it seems logical that if there was ever a place where it was going to be brought up, that scene on the stairs, you know, would be it. It's like, you know this demon, Father. It called out your name when you walked in. Who is this?
So even Dimmy doesn't ask, what's that all about? Right?
Call out. Yeah, and that's always, I wouldn't call it a mistake exactly, but it's always intrigued me as to why this bit was left out.
Yeah.
And why Blatty would claim, if I had to guess, it would be Pazuzu. But hey, who knows?
The demon has Legion's personality, I think.
Yeah.
I think it talks and acts like Legion from the Book of Luke, which is how the book opens.
Well, there's a tie-in to that that I don't remember you guys mentioning at the time, but when, Legion is cast into a herd of pigs, right? When the demon first speaks, she says, "The sow is mine."
And he keeps on calling her the piglet. And
the piglet, yes. So I think you're right, Keenan. I think that would have been a more justifiable choice. Yeah. But again, I'm not Blatty.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like he wants to do that, and then his sequel book is called Legion. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
I mean, people are so tired of me talking about this. But
we'll talk. Use Professor Farnsworth's voice, and then we won't be tired.
Well, everyone, if I had to guess,
I remember reading that as well. I remember mm-hmm. Blatty specifically stating that it was Pazuzu, and I think it was that blurb right there that you're talking about, Alex. And I mean, just like with all of this other stuff, I think the story of The Exorcist has gotten away from him in a really good way. Like, it's gotten really, really popular, and it's become a little bit different from the thing that he originally created, right? With the head spinning around and the crucifix and the, you know, all these other changes that became like more popular than his book. And if I had to guess, is a reaction to the popularity of the demon Pazuzu after this movie. Mm-hmm. So I can see fans, you know, discovering this. Oh yeah, that statue is Pazuzu. And yeah, Pazuzu is mentioned in the book. Hey, Blatty, dear right. Blatty, is that, like, who is that demon? Is that Pazuzu? And him just kind of being like, you know what? You know, like, there's the statue appears in the bedroom at some mm-hmm. point in the movie. Yeah. We see all these, you know, close-ups of the statue. Yeah, sure. If I had to guess, you know, put a gun to my head, flying fuck through a rolling donut, to quote my best friend. Yeah. Yeah. I think he's saying that in response to the people's reaction of the movie. Mm. Yeah. But folks, that is that's all of our notes. Mm-hmm. Fellas, Keenan, Alex, is there anything else we got?
No, I think we got it.
I think I've got everything.
All right.
Yeah. Well, Alex, we love talking to you, even if it is about things that you hate about the version you've never seen. We could talk to you all day. Thanks so much for coming back and doing a episode on the movie with us in addition to your bonus episode.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been a blast. I love this podcast.
Thank you, Alex. All right, folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You can find me on Letterboxd and Instagram at Howdy Keenan. And then about yourself, Alex?
Yeah.
I'm at alexbledsoe.com. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Mm-hmm. My latest book is an audio short story collection called Give the People What They Want. That's available on Audible and all the other fun places. Yeah. And my Southern Fried Possession novel, Dandelion, is available from Falstaff Books at all the usual suspects and also on Audible.
Check that book out, folks. All right. And as for us, we got our listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. And Alex is in there with us as well, so you can say hi to him. Yep. Is that okay? I'm giving them permission to, you know, stalk you in our listener. Okay, good.
No, I wouldn't be on social media if I didn't want to talk to people.
All right, good, good, good. And thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media. And a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star ratings on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to our show. We really appreciate it. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay. Keenan, Alex, are you guys thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
I think I am, Lester, too.
Folks, until next time,
the power of Sesame Street compels you.
Keenan, what's your favorite Sesame Street character?
Oh, well, I cheat because I say it's Kermit the Frog.
That is cheating.
No. I could be bastard. Myself. he is a regular on Sesame Street.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Is he a resident of the street?
No, he would never.
whoa. We're finding out some. Wait, why would he? You sounded. He's jumped on that.
He's taken Manhattan. right? He's the Muppets. They've done the Great Manhattan Muppet Caper or whatever. Okay. And yeah, he lives in a big a penthouse apartment with his pig wife. He doesn't need to come uptown and
so what are you saying about Sesame Street? Are you saying Sesame Street's like he's too good for Sesame Street now?
Yes, I am saying that.
Amphibians are always the first to be gentrified.
Oh boy,
that's right.
Jesus,
because they're permeable skin, Lester.
Now, Alex, who's your favorite character on Sesame Street?
Bert.
Oh,
I sympathize with Bert's exasperation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who is the Ernie in your life that does that to you? Or just
every
everybody?
Other human being in existence. No, I there are some people I love.
Mm-hmm. We'll leave it at that. I just love that phrasing. It's like, there are some people I love.
Not any that come to mind right now.
Well, no, I have a list, but it's downstairs.
All right, Lester, who's your favorite Sesame Street character?
Oh no, I think I'm an Oscar the Grouch guy.
Oh yes,
uh-huh. Yeah. I like my alone time. I like my, you know.
Yeah. He picks up his own house to move around.
Yeah.
So he's super ripped.
Yes. Right. He's like that metal can can barely contain him. Contain those guns. Those gross, grouchy guns. Right. There's this wonderful little comic, this little meme where the rest of the Sesame Street gang, they're like, "We pitched in and bought you a house." And then the next panel is just this vast kitchen, you know, completely spotless. And then just in the corner is that little, you know, it's like a kitchen trash can that you step on and it goes, you know, opens up the little lid. And you just see Oscar's eyes poking out. And he's just terrified of so much space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why we can't have gross things.
Yeah. Oh, guys, I forgot. No, I would be so remiss if I didn't mention this. No, my favorite Sesame Street character is Saint Bartholomew's flayed skin.
It takes two hands to operate him down there.
Right. That's one of the only Muppets made out of leather.
Well, I guess mine would have to be then Meenosh's Dick Snake.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting, guys. I was going to say that my favorite Sesame Street character is the friendship between all three of us.
Yeah.